roundtable, these 3 weeks of roundtable discussions, are sponsored not only by this commission, the Alaska Native Review Commission, but as well by the Humanities Forum of the State of Alaska, whose chairman, Chris Cook, he was recently chairman, and whose new chairman, Ron Scollin, and the executive director, Gary Holtas, have worked closely with the commission in arranging these overview meetings. And indeed, without the commission's, without the assistance of the Humanities Forum, these roundtable discussions would not be taking place. I can't resist saying that the long written document you received describing the commission, the project description, I think it's called, was prepared for the Humanities Forum, and that's why it refers to broad humanitarian considerations. And I, if I may say so, think that it is an excellent way of introducing the discussion, and I think those broad moral and ethical considerations are appropriate to be considered. It was, I think, if I may be forgiven for saying so, notable last week that those who came here from Washington, D.C., two of the three of them suggested that references to de Tocqueville and to Las Casas and to the ancient origin of these questions going back to the Spanish conquest were nice, but not the sort of thing that, you know, really practical men and women in 1984 could get their teeth into, and that we had to look instead at the Act, specific changes, talk to the power brokers in Washington, D.C., and get on with it. Well, I was grateful to them for expressing that view, but I do hope you won't, that you'll feel free to range widely over history and economics and literature and race relations and whatever else comes into your head. Well, forgive me for that long-winded introduction, but I did want to acquaint you with, you know, the story thus far. And here we are, and might I in just a moment call on Joe Jorgensen. We will carry on, I hope, till about 12:15. If you feel like a cup of coffee at any time, please feel free to get up and help yourself and come back again. This isn't a formal sort of setup. And after I've called on Joe Jorgensen, I'll call on Ralph Johnson to carry the discussion from there, and then I'll call on Ada Deer, and after that, maybe we can just play it by ear. So Joe, forgive me, you just begin now, if you would.
Thank you, Justice Berger, and distinguished participants. It's indeed an honor to be here. I've Mr. Justice, Chairman.
Not all Justice right. Berger, the name is Berger. And, there's a reason for making that distinction.
What they wanted was land, not money. What they were given was some money and not land. To retain ancestral land in perpetuity for future generations and for the past was what was desired. But where do you turn when all the force is on the other side and has been for so long? They turned and they looked right into the eye of termination legislation, House Concurrent Resolution 108, a sense of Congress saying we should proceed now and terminate Indians. We can do many things for them. We can move this Papago Hopi Rehabilitation Act, Navajo Rehabilitation Act, and send Indians to cities. We can relocate them, give them on-the-job training, sever their ties with the tribes. So that's one thing they did. They created then a Relocation Act from it. But we will terminate them from federal services as they are prepared to be terminated. 104 Indian societies were terminated following several special acts of Congress. I have one resident from a terminated tribe with us. I'm sure we'll hear about it. the termination worked something like this. Among the small Southern Paiute groups and the groups of Western Oregon, that among the Southern Paiutes, for instance, they were not asked whether they wanted to be terminated and under what conditions and how they would deal with the world after termination. But they had provided to them, often tacked at the post office in Cedar City and Kanawha and Kanab, Utah, at Barrel Junction, the nature of the Termination Act that would be carried to them, that they could see, that they could disagree with, they could vote on, yes or no. The Southern Paiute were terminated. One little group of Southern Paiute, the Kanawha Band, they had 400 acres. $100.
As the staff of Senator Jackson at the time, and obviously has an interest in having a success in something that he worked so hard at and tried so very hard to make into a successful product. But I don't think there's any doubt but what ANCSA was concerned at that time, and this goes back to the history that existed in 1970-71, Indian governance was not the major thing that was in the minds of either Congress or the Indian communities at that time, at least not articulated outside those communities. And so ANCSA tended to reflect that notion that we were dealing with a land settlement, whereas increasingly it has become apparent, in the lower 48 at least, that some of the most important things to the tribes there is the power to govern. And that power of governance is easily as important as the land base that is in question. And I think that's the question that was not adequately addressed in ANCSA and is left in somewhat disarray and confusion by all the events that have occurred since then.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. That was an excellent supplement to what Mr. Jorgensen said. We can turn to you now. If you'd like to start after lunch, whatever suits you.
Commissioner Bridger?
Yes.
Is John Stevens going to be here?
No.
Well, then, I passed over the Passamaquoddy because I thought that he would be here. But I would like to just say a couple of things about it, and others can join in. It's crucial, and I think it's very important to Alaska Natives.
Please do.
When the first Court of Appeals affirmed the district court decision, they did the following. They said that the Passamaquoddy were a tribe, that the Non-Intercourse Act applied to the Passamaquoddy, that the federal government had a trust obligation to the Passamaquoddy, and that the United States could not deny Passamaquoddy's request for litigation against the state of Maine.
Rights and unity for Menominee shareholders. And our thrust was to stop the land sales, to work for restoration, and to have Menominees in the positions of power. Now, this movement all started about 1969, 1970. And when you think about how long it takes to get a law through Congress, or a bill through Congress, it was a very short time. Our Menominee Restoration legislation was signed into law on December 22, 1973. But again, I want to emphasize the long discussions and the opposition to termination that our people had. At any rate, we had many meetings. We drafted up a legislation. And there are still people that are unhappy with the restoration legislation because they didn't understand the legislative process, that there has to be compromise. Some people thought that because they came to a meeting and they gave their ideas that they would be automatically included and that's what would happen. At any rate, for those of you that are interested, you can certainly study the restoration legislation. But we did get the Menominee tribe restored. We opened up the rolls. We started a whole new relationship with the federal government. And people ask, well, how are the Menominees doing now? I say, well, we have to learn how to get along with one another now. But the land is safe, and the control is back in the hands of the Menominees. We organized an extremely sophisticated proxy campaign to regain control even before restoration occurred. A number of us ran for the voting trust. Several of us were voted in, and this meant a lot of work on the parts of people. We had to call up people. We had to go and track them down. We had to get their proxies, their signatures. And the other side was willing to fight, too. And so we would go, oftentimes we would get one proxy, and the people would come in right after us and get their proxy. So we never really knew completely accurately what the proxy count was. But we appealed to the sense of tribalism. We appeal to the love of land, which we know is in the hearts and minds of all Indian people. And so, to make a long story short, you know, we won. Now, we had to undergo a lot of opposition. We were called, you know, agitators and outsiders and unemployed and so on and so on. And there, a number of us eventually ended up in more leadership positions. But out of the Indian business of saving money, and actually it ended up costing a lot of money. The federal government had to make a number of appropriations for health services and for other kinds of services on a reservation. I know it was millions of dollars. I don't recall what the exact amount is at this point, but the Menominees basically were a self-sufficient tribe, paid the salaries of the Bureau of Indian Affairs people, and maintained a minimum level of services such as a hospital and some other services, and then to go from that status to one of a termination where the land was starting to get lost and where people didn't have any services and where the federal government continually appropriated millions of dollars shows the fallacy of the thinking of the terminationists.
Patty Ginsburg, last question before we move on.
Last question. I don't know if you're aware, in Alaska, the shareholders in the regional and village corporations often live in a completely different area from where their corporation is headquartered. On the Menominee Reservation, when you started your re-enrollment, do the members have to live on the reservation? Were there any provisions for people who lived off it?
No, one does not have to live on the reservation to be enrolled as a member of the tribe. You have to have the required blood quantum, which is 1/4.
All right. Well, Mr. Russell Jim, we're looking forward now to hearing from you, sir.
Nech Pachuayal, Tlachwaman, Kuchiskwe, Chitichum, Kunasakan of Shinam Yanai, Kunam Natchik Shawimin Pupre, Kushki and I, Nas Natchik in Miwau Naksh Miwak Ishwit, Kukwayan, Ike Tamas Tun Chow Nam with Doctor Tun Chow Ha I Paish. Justice Berger, fellow colleagues, honored hosts of this land. As dramatic as this may be, I think.
Say something now, you're welcome. And if you don't complete it before they come bustling in with their bingo cards at 4, well, we'll certainly make you first up tomorrow morning, so.
I think the kinds of things that I have to say with regards to matters that are related to Alaska Natives is by contrast, because the Pueblo peoples are very different than the Natives of Alaska. And I think that I may have to give some background.
Please do.
I left New Mexico in a snowstorm. I dropped into Anchorage, and it was very warm. The Pueblo people of New Mexico are about 34,000 strong. They occupy two states in New Mexico and in Arizona. There's 19 Pueblos in New Mexico. The 19 Pueblos range from Taos in the north to below Albuquerque in the south. Those are the 19 Pueblos in New Mexico. Interestingly enough, when the Spanish first came to New Mexico, there were some 88,000 peoples, Pueblo peoples there. In some 100 years' time, the population had dwindled to 10,000 Pueblo Indians. The Spanish came in 1540.